Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the regular Saturday show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. We're in the midst of what I'm calling a summer of scripture on Unbelievable, and I'm going to be introducing two distinguished New Testament experts to debate the resurrection today. I'll be explaining exactly what angle we're taking in a moment's time, but later on today, between 4 and 5, you can hear The Profile. I'll be speaking to two former BBC producers, Chris Rees and Patrick Forbes, ahead of a re-airing of the classic BBC religious series Priestland's Progress this coming week on Premier. Later on, we'll also be hearing some of your feedback to the last two really interesting weeks of debate between Tim McGrew and Bart Ehrman. But that's to come later on in the programme. Right now, let's get into today's discussion.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, we're asking, do the minimal facts support the resurrection of Jesus? And I'll be explaining exactly what the minimal facts hypothesis is with my guest today, Gary Habermas. He's a scholar of history and philosophy based out at Liberty University in Virginia. He's written extensively, though, on the evidence for the resurrection. And that's going to be our theme on this first of two programmes in which he joins me along with James Crossley, who's a New Testament scholar at Sheffield University with an interest especially in the historical Jesus and Judaism. In fact, he has a new book out on that, The Historical Jesus and the Chaos of History. And I'll be introducing you to both my guests, their faith positions and what we're going to be talking about during the course of today's programme. Going to be a great edition of Unbelievable. So, Gary and James, welcome both to Unbelievable. Great to have you on today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've both been on the programme, but not together in the past. I think probably several years ago now, James, you joined me to do a couple of discussions with Richard Borkham on his book Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, as well as another one he'd written at the time on Jesus and the God of Israel. But you yourself are a New Testament scholar, though perhaps in the minority, in the sense that you don't have any faith sort of commitments yourself as far as belief in God or the truth of Christianity and so on.
No, those are not my concerns as a New Testament scholar. And I think I'd probably differ from a number of New Testament scholars in the respect that I keep those questions entirely separate from the work I do as a historian and critic of New Testament texts. As an analogy, the same way a historian might approach Henry VIII or something like that. That's what it really means to me. And I take as much pleasure out of historical reconstruction and history as I guess other people would out of issues of faith.
I think you've got an interest, though, in kind of looking at the Gospels in a political context as well, don't you? You've been doing some writing and research on that recently.
That's right. I mean, I work in two different areas, really. One is things all around the first century, Christian origins, historical Jesus, early Judaism and so on. But the other side of what I do is 20th century and 21st century politics and the use of the Bible in particularly English politics, although sometimes in American, and the way various politicians like Thatcher, Blair, Cameron, and so on, use the Bible in political discourse. But I'm also interested in what happened to it. A very strong tradition of kind of radical Bible interpretation in English politics, which has been pushed out of Parliament over the past 40 years, and what happened to that?
Well, it sounds like there's a whole nother episode of Unbelievable in that.
Absolutely.
At some point down the
line. Invite me on.
We'll come back to you about your most recent book in a moment's time, but just to introduce Gary, who joins me. Gary, last time I think you were on Unbelievable, we were actually sitting in the vestry of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, or what was historically vestry in Westminster Chapel, having a kind of recorded discussion with an atheist on miracles and near-death experiences and things like that. So people, if they're interested, can search back in the archives for that. But you've come on today for this first of two shows to really talk about what has been something that's been at the centre of your studies for a long time now. When did you first get interested in the historical evidence for the resurrection?
Well, long before I went to graduate school, I had gone through a rather long, sustained period of doubts. Mm-hmm. I was raised in a German Baptist home, but sometime later I started thinking, you know, this is all well and good, but how much of this is because it's established and how much of this is because I was taught this, you know, even because I'm in the West or, you know, something like that. And so I started being bothered by the fact that a lot of Christians were citing a lot of things that seemed to be prejudice or other things and not established. So I had a lot of doubts, and relatives of mine who were not keen on me giving up Christianity because I had some rough times. As a matter of fact, I announced that I thought I was going to be becoming a Buddhist pretty soon.
Oh, right.
I said, I made the comment that probably within a few months the change would be complete. And then years later, I'm not even sure the change hadn't already happened.
Right.
So some of them got a little bit worried about me, and they started, you know, check this out. Look at the authorship of the Gospels. Look at the reliability of the New Testament. How about archaeology? How about creation? How about... And I started studying these things, and I suppose I enjoyed the reliability of the New Testament-type discussions more than anything. But for the most part, I thought they were more or less dead ends, some more probable than others, but I wasn't sure if any of them could bear the weight of the Christian message. In fact, I was kind of sure that none of them could, at least for me. Then I happened on the resurrection in my studies, and I thought, wow, if Jesus was raised from the dead, and it's not just data about an event, we have to talk about the person who was raised. So there's a worldview context for the event. And if it's a person about whom certain things are true, now at that early time, scholars were not conceding that Jesus was a miracle worker and the tomb was empty. And those are still real minority views because when I started studying this, the New Testament world was still in the throes of Rudolf Bultmann's influence. This was back in the 60s and early 70s. And actually, Rudolf Bultmann died the same year I finished my PhD. But so I came into it from a very personal viewpoint. And the minimal facts argument was an argument that basically says, if all we know is what the skeptics say about the New Testament, and I didn't care what kind of skeptic they were, atheist, agnostic, generally a skeptic, whatever, seeker. Whatever they were, take that New Testament, and I, after pushing and pushing and pushing the envelope, I came to the view that even their text, their critically ascertained text, say the authentic epistles of Paul, applying certain criteria to the Gospels and so on, you could come up with a view that the resurrection of Jesus was the most likely explanation for the disciples' experiences. So I tell people it started as a selfish thing. It was me and my doubts. And it ended up with kind of this, when you hear minimal facts, maybe you think lowest common denominator, kind of, if we share these views.
If we can agree
roughly,
on a very basic set of
now where do we go
data,
with it?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Well, we'll come to it. We're going to discuss the minimal facts themselves in the course of the program today. James, we've had you on before to talk about resurrection and that kind of thing. I mean, your interest is in Jesus generally, though, historically. Very briefly, what's your new book about, then, the Jesus and the Chaos of History?
Yes, I find it very difficult to summarise my own work, and I usually get it wrong.
But the idea is to look at Jesus almost. I don't want this to be misunderstood, but kind of as a metaphor, almost the ways in which the traditions about Jesus tell us something about the social and economic changes that were happening in Galilee at the time. So I'm kind of both sort of sceptical and conservative with a lot of the tradition. I mean, I don't know how far we can go back to say this is the historical Jesus. In fact, because of a lack of complementary evidence, I find it very difficult to make a definitive statement. That's not to say that Jesus didn't do X, Y, or Z. I just don't think I can come anywhere close to proving it. But what I think we can do is look at the kind of themes and issues that perhaps were present in Galilee and Palestine prior to the Gospels in, say, the 20s and 30s that helped generate a new movement that we've gone to label Christianity. And really trying to see how that engages with socioeconomic issues of the time, irrespective of whether the people responsible for these early traditions knew it or not. And the other angle of this is to see how the gospel traditions played off against issues of power and empire. So, again, it may be unconscious, but I think a number of the traditions are both a reaction to issues of, sort of Roman imperial rule or kind of puppet rulers and so on, and provide a narrative of an alternative rule, kingdom of God, and things like this. So I look at kind of this cross-culturally, the ways in which upheavals, revolutions, to put in inverted commas, generate ideas that can go off in all sorts of chaotic directions. They can be faithfully restored. They can be completely misinterpreted. They can be dormant, and get that later interpreters pick up on these and develop movements in all sorts of different ways.
Again, another whole show there, I'm sure.
Back for that one as well.
Maybe we'll get to pick up some of that in the second show that we're going to do with you guys, where we'll be throwing quite a few listener questions at you both across the course of a second show. So that's one to come back for next week if you're interested in that. Just quickly, links to both my guests if you want to find out more about them. James, you can find blogging at historicalchaos.wordpress.com, and Gary's material available at garyhabermas.com. Today on the programme, we're asking, do the minimal facts support the resurrection of Jesus?
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, it's such a treat to have you both in the studio with me today. But where should we start? I think probably with you, again, laying out, Gary, what these minimal facts are, as far as you're concerned. So these are the facts which, in your opinion, the majority of even sceptical, if you like, New Testament historians agree on regarding the data surrounding the crucifixion and resurrection narratives of Jesus. So lay these out for us and we'll start discussing them.
Okay, and this isn't the whole life of Jesus. This is roughly from the crucifixion onwards. And I often start with a list of what I call the 12 accepted facts. It's a more general list. And then I break the 12 down to 6 that I think are more substantial. And I flip back and forth in my writings. I don't have magic numbers. Sometimes the 12 becomes 14. Sometimes the 12 becomes 10. Sometimes at the minimal facts, I work anywhere from 3 to 7. And the reason the numbers change, and I don't care that they change, is because generally nobody grants only these data. I mean, even a Rudolf Bultmann, for example, I think is going to give me more than these 12. Now, he may disagree. He's going to disagree with the empty tomb, which is one of the larger lists, but not the shorter list. But because more scholars will admit other things, I don't have to be so careful and say, this is the list, because there is no list, per se. Now, having said that, I'll start with what I often identify as minimal facts. I'll just, give 6 of them and then tell you what the greater list looks like. I'll just name them.
Go for it.
No defense.
Yeah.
For minimal facts, I'd say Jesus died by Roman crucifixion. And then I would jump right to the fact that afterwards his disciples had experiences, real experiences, which they believed to be appearances of the risen Jesus. And I'm real particular about that language. Thirdly, they were transformed. They proceeded to turn the eastern end of the Mediterranean and other places upside down at that point with their preaching, and they were willing to die. I don't think we can prove all the disciples were martyrs. But by the way, we do have first century records for the martyrdoms of Paul, Peter, and James, mm-hmm. and a second century reference for John. But I don't put I don't spend much time on martyrdom. Martyrdom is not a point per se. It's their transformation to the point of being sold out. Yeah. And then James and Paul, two, I think, previous skeptics, Paul for sure, two previous skeptics were converted by what they thought were appearances, also what they thought were appearances of the risen Jesus. So that's six. Crucifixion, experience of the disciples, the
transformation.
Transformation, James and Paul.
James and Paul. So that's four there. Is that right?
I have six. Now, I'm separating James and Paul because they're different people in different circumstances.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, okay, right. Okay.
Now, if I were to expand that list, I would include things like Eileen, I would say a private burial is more likely than not.
Yeah.
I'm going to add the empty tomb. Okay. Now, my head count, I've tried to number scholars from 1975 to the present in French, German, and English, the major works. And my studies have shown that approximately two-thirds to three-quarters of scholars grant the empty tomb. Now, of course, granting is nothing to do with historicity. That's just where people are. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, I know that between a quarter and a third of scholars will disagree with the empty tomb, mm-hmm. for example. The disciples despaired after the cross, mm-hmm. normal psychological reaction, and the Gospels portray it. They, you know, were ready to go fishing. They were ready to go back to their homes. They thought it was lost. Peter denied the Lord, those sorts of things. Jerusalem proclamation, that the place of the proclamation was in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And Sunday worship, the worship day. You know what? I know, Justin, why you may have been confused by that first list of six. Not only do I spin off Paul and James, but I didn't mention one of them. The earliness of the proclamation.
Right. I was going to say, it still only came to five, not on six.
Yes, you're right. You were very kind.
Earliness of the proclamation. Okay,
it was proclaimed very, very early. I would say 30s A.D., early 30s, I would argue. So that's the six and about six on the other side.
Yeah,
list of 12.
We'll never cover all of that, of course, in any depth.
No.
But it's an interesting list to get us thinking. And in this first part of the program, I want to just get James's take on this and have some discussion between you guys as to what you make of this list, James. Which ones can you kind of say, yeah, I'm broadly in agreement with that, this, that, and the other? So first of all, where are your points of agreement, maybe, with Gary in terms of this this list of data surrounding these stories?
I think I'm probably in broad agreement with what Gary said. Interestingly, I think that the appearances, the resurrection appearances, is some of the hardest, best evidence we have in historical reconstruction. So what we find in 1 Corinthians 15 about Paul receiving this tradition about who saw the risen Jesus, mm-hmm. I think I would agree with Gary there. I think it's very difficult to disagree, in fact, that this is very early material. Mm-hmm. We assume that this stuff happened. People saw something. So how it couldn't be something like the very early 30s is almost impossible.
So you agree in that sense that people experienced something?
Yes.
You're not properly prepared to say it was the risen Christ, but
they
had an experience that they attributed to.
Yes. I think this, Christ. I mean, if we were to push this further onto the kind of bigger metaphysical questions. Mm. I think that's where me and Gary would disagree.
Sure.
I'm prepared to go to the level of belief on this, and that people were convinced that they had seen the risen Christ, and that's fine by me. Yeah. That's good evidence, good historical evidence.
Okay.
I won't make the jump after
that. We'll come to that later. Any other ones that you sort of are happy
crucifixion,
to broadly agree? Obviously,
The real one that I have my doubts would be the issues of the empty tomb and the private tomb. Now, on the private tomb, it's not that I can disprove it or necessarily want to disprove it or the like. It's just that really, if we're dealing with Mark's account as the kind of basic account there, the private tomb, then that's all we've got. Now, it could be that Mark is entirely accurate. Joseph of Arimathea buried Jesus. And it's also clear, I think, that, you know, later tradition does develop this. And, you could argue that Mark retains something of a kind of early...
What would make you doubt? Is it because that wasn't the way crucifixion victims were treated in general? What would be the reason for doubting Mark's account of Joseph of Arimathea burying him? There isn't a doubt,
and I only say this is a doubt. I don't think it can be brought to anything like what we might call the level of proof, is that there were alternative ways of dealing with crucifixion victims, the common argument about the mass burial or communal burial and so on. you know, it's theoretically possible that something like that happened and then a tradition was invented to try to explain away something like that. Now, that's not proof, that's just a possibility. Sure. It's also possible that Joseph of Arimathea buried Jesus as well. Mm. I just can't, I don't think there's enough evidence to make a decision either way on that. The empty tomb is the other one where I probably
now just explain empty tomb. But when you say, Gary, that there's a minimal fact about the empty tomb, do you mean that people claimed to discover an empty tomb where Jesus's body had once been?
They came to the private tomb and it was empty. But just one point of clarification: I don't count the empty tomb as a minimal fact.
You don't.
I count it as part of the larger list of accepted facts. Because I have two qualifications for minimal facts. Mm-hmm. One is that I won't accept any point of data for which there is not multiple arguments coming down. And I think when James says the part about the disciples' visions or experiences being the most evidenced, that's this kind of thing.
Yeah.
The second one is, because of that, the vast majority of scholars agree. I don't see that strong head count on empty tomb.
On empty tomb.
So it's not anything about the evidence. Yeah. It's about...
It's about the number of scholars who...
A quarter to a third of scholars reject it, so it doesn't fit my criteria.
What about the third minimal fact Gary outlined, the transformation of the followers of Jesus? Do you agree there was a transformation?
Yes. Clearly. I mean, I don't think you can argue with that. It's fairly obvious. A new movement develops in the name of Jesus. Resurrection is one of the central features of this. There were clearly visions attributed to Paul, James, 500, and so on. I think it's a fairly obvious point.
And the James and Paul conversion, you're happy to kind of more or less go along that they appear to have conversions linked to the claims of the resurrected Jesus appearing to
Yes, because it's based on 1 Corinthians 15, that report that was handed on to him. It's very difficult to argue against.
So it's in a sense, again, you're broadly actually in agreement with quite a lot of these minimal facts that Gary puts out there. Some of those extended list of facts, if you like, you would not sure about the
empty tomb. In fact, just for the record, I mean, all the ones you agreed with were the minimal ones. The two you questioned, personal burial, empty tomb, were both the larger list. So what we're calling the smaller list, I think we're right on.
I think so,
Okay. Shall we go to the list to find some areas where you're not? So empty tomb, you said, that's just on the basis of what Mark writes about Joseph of Arimathea, so not so convinced.
There's another reason why I'm a bit sceptical about the empty tomb. It's two reasons. Is that 1 Corinthians 15 doesn't mention it. Now, it's difficult because I think 1 Corinthians 15 probably assumes the idea that Jesus left behind an empty tomb when resurrected. I'm convinced by some of the kind of conservative arguments on that one. But it's not hard evidence for there actually being an empty tomb. The other reason I'm sceptical is because the other early source we have, Mark 16, 1 through to 8, ends with a non-resurrection appearance as such, just implied. Mm. And I think it's possible, although I don't know how hard I'd push this, I think it's possible to read that as a potential explanation as to how do we explain the tomb of Jesus? Or was there an empty tomb? Well, it wasn't. The women didn't tell anyone or something like this. Mm. So, again, you can't push these too hard. But it's for those two early sources not to be kind of problematic makes me a bit sceptical about the possibility of the empty tomb and hence those kind of wider range of facts that Gary points out.
Now, obviously, Gary, you believe that the empty tomb, in your opinion, there is good evidence that there was an empty tomb and so on. But what you're saying is not all scholars that agree at the level at which you would class it as the so-called minimal fact.
Right. My two requirements for minimal facts, again, are good data from multiple angles. Mm-hmm. And therefore, because the data are good, there's a large percentage headcount. I would say in the 90s before empty tomb is not in the 90s. So I don't accept it as an empty fact. In fact, in a lot of my writings, people will say I accept the minimal fact, and I've corrected it many times and corrected them many times in print and say, no, I've never included them. Even going back to my dissertation, I've never included as that core.
Sure. I, maybe people – I know that others people use a similar methodology to you. William Lane Craig, for instance, in his debates on the resurrection,
yes,
uses a set of minimal facts. I think one of his is the discovery of an empty tomb by a group of Jesus' women followers.
I think he does put it in there, and I just... Now,
and you wouldn't go as far as him in seeing
but if
that.
All, I'd have to talk to Bill. If all Bill is saying is these are very well attested, I think the empty tomb belongs to that list.
Sure.
But if you say very well attested and virtually all scholars agree,
right,
you can't put it in there.
Okay.
So, but your original question, I just gave a lecture, actually it's being published, 21 arguments for an empty tomb. So I think there's fantastic data. And all of these, by the way, none of them require a traditional date, a traditional comment and authorship of the Gospels or any really disputed thing. They include things like Jerusalem preaching. How could they be preaching in the city of Jerusalem if you could walk down to a tomb and nothing was there? If they made a claim that it's a tomb, why women? You know, the women argument, which you address. Things like a pre-Markan crucifixion narrative, if there's a source before Mark that knows this. James has already mentioned that he does say that 1 Corinthians 15, there's some implications there, but he doesn't think it arises to the fact of an argument. I probably agree with that pretty clearly, what he just said, but I think 1 Corinthians 15 has some force there. The sermon summary in Acts chapter 13, which Bart Ehrman dates to 31 or 32 A.D., records putting a body down and a body coming out without being corrupted.
Yeah.
So I think there's about 20 of those that you can list.
For those who maybe are struggling to keep up with some of these biblical references, 1 Corinthians 15, why is that so important to this area of study exactly? Why go there first almost before you go to the gospel accounts of the resurrection?
I'd like to hear what James says about this. It's just my own take. I think if there's a unanimous New Testament conclusion on the kind of data we're talking about right here, across the board, no matter how conservative, how liberal, it is that 1 Corinthians 15 and following, Paul is presenting creedal data. Synonyms, though not exact, would be words like confession / tradition, and it would be one of the oral statements that's being passed around. Paul himself says, I gave you what I was given. And it's right now both Richard Baucom and others have argued that the consensus New Testament position is that this goes back to the early 30s AD.
Yeah.
So I think the reason you have to start with 1 Corinthians 15 is that it's very early, it's very authoritative, it's cited by Paul, whom everybody respects, in one of the authentic Pauline books. Mm-hmm. Paul knew the guys in question, Galatians 1, Galatians 2. He knows them. He's reporting their beliefs, so it's pretty solid. And it gives you that list of appearances.
So it's so close in that sense. We can tie it so historically close to the events he's reporting, and it seems to be something that's already been established that he's then writing down for his audience and so on. This obviously, you know, and you're nodding in agreement primarily.
Yeah, I mean,
that,
I'll read it out, James. Actually. So this is 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 and following. For I handed on to you as of first importance what I in turn had received.
Mm.
This is kind of standard language for receiving traditions. First of all, there's a sort of general statement that's kind of ahistorical, if you like, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures. He appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, 500, James, and last of all, to Paul. Now, that's a tradition that's handed on.
Yeah.
We've got this Paul writing in 1 Corinthians. This isn't anything, you know, this is Paul. We know this is Paul.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking mid-50s, let's say, give or take a year either side, year or two either side. So this is really, this is kind of gold. This is kind of the evidence I wish we'd have right across the board in a way. but the ironic thing is, of course, you know, for all the kind of complexities of historical reconstruction, it's the resurrection appearances, which is probably the strongest piece of evidence we have.
That's such an interesting thing to hear said. And but the question then, of course, that all of this points to is, does it give us good enough reasons to actually say a resurrection took place? And that's where I think we're going to have, obviously, the divergence of opinion between you both. But we'll come to that, because we're just going to go to a break, and then I'll let you ask your question, Gary. We're running out of time in this first section. So I'm excited for what the next section brings. As we ask, do these minimal facts, which, as we've heard, James broadly agrees on with most of them, with Gary, actually give rise to an argument for a miracle, essentially, the resurrection of Jesus? Are you listening to Unbelievable? Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, this Saturday afternoon. I'll give you the ways to get in touch as well as we enter the second part of today's programme in just a moment's time.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
This month, the Vicar of Holy Trinity Brompton, Nicky Gumble, gives an exclusive interview on the church's ambitious planting strategy as HDB seeks to breathe new life into dying congregations around the UK. We ask, what can Christians do to defy ISIS? And meet a Mormon. Michael Flournoy explains his beliefs, while Lynn Wilder tells her story of leaving the Mormon Church for Christianity.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Yes, this is the show where top people in their area get together with me, Justin Brierley, to discuss and debate the truth of Christianity. And we're really going to the central issue in Christianity. Did Jesus rise from the dead on today's programme? And do the minimal facts specifically that we have at our hands, the historical data, support the hypothesis that Jesus really did rise from the dead? Gary Habermas, scholar of history and philosophy based at Liberty University and someone who's written extensively in this area, joins me in studio, along with James Crossley, a New Testament scholar at Sheffield University. Now, James is an agnostic as far as faith commitments are concerned, and he said at the very outset that he thinks we should treat the two areas, if you like, faith and faith commitments, very distinctly from how we do our history and so on. And this raises the whole question of whether we can come to the conclusion that, given the historical data, the best explanation of the facts is that Jesus rose from the dead. And I think that's where we're going to be looking at in the course of the rest of our discussion, gentlemen. But if you'd like to get in touch and give us your thoughts on what's been said already on today's programme, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address, and you can leave your comments underneath today's programme at the website as well, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can also find links there to the podcast, to other resources, video, and much more. And of course, the Facebook and Twitter accounts as well, if you'd like to get in touch that way. This is the first of two shows, actually, where we're lucky enough to have James and Gary with us. And next week, we'll be hearing some of the questions you put to them via Twitter and Facebook and other ways, just on all different aspects of the New Testament. So we look forward to that next week. But let's talk about these minimal facts then, and whether they do support the hypothesis of the resurrection. Start with you, James. Why for you, even if you could agree on a lot of these, and even the extensive list, say, that Gary gives, why is a resurrection still not, and never could be, I suppose, the best explanation of those facts?
I would just bracket it out, really. It's not something I feel kind of as someone who would identify as a historian can come around to remotely proving. Things like the miraculous, supernatural are just beyond what the kinds of things I can do. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I'd apply that to any era, any period, any context, and so on. So what I would be more interested in is the level of belief, mm-hmm. and the impact of belief in kind of miracles, resurrection, or so on. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think, you know, abstractly, I'm not saying this is what I actually think, but it's entirely possible that things like nature miracles of Jesus, those stories could have been told whilst Jesus was alive. Mm-hmm. That's not proof they happened or didn't happen, mm-hmm. But it would be, if you could show that, it would be proof of belief.
Yes.
Likewise with the resurrection, I think we've got very strong evidence that people really did believe they saw
the resurrected
Jesus. And that clearly, as Gary said, transforms people, and it clearly plays some significant role in the development of Christianity and Christology, for example. I mean, for instance, if you see the resurrected Jesus, well, you're already speculating in effect on who this figure is. Sure. He's a heavenly figure, and so on and so forth. So it's a very important way of getting that ball rolling, I think. So I would always stick with that level of belief. I don't think you can go one step back and say, and therefore the supernatural, as a historian.
Sure. All you can be reasonably certain about is what people believed. You cannot say beyond that, and it actually happened.
Yes. I mean, I wouldn't say this for everything. You know, I mean, the one example people would throw up in this kind of approach to history would be something like the Holocaust. Mm. You know, are you therefore saying that you can't show that the Holocaust happened or not? And I said, no, you can.
But we're not talking
that.
About a supernatural claim in that
exactly,
sense, are we?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when it comes to something like the supernatural, I mean, that's just beyond anything right. I could. I mean, I guess Gary's got philosophical training.
Before we come to Gary for a response on this, are you required then as a historian to put some other explanation forward for why they had all of these things if we can't actually say it's the thing that they said was responsible for
these facts? I've no desire to go around and try to debunk things. You have to give some kind of explanation, and I think you can do that by focusing on the level of belief. I think it is helpful to think of these things cross-culturally. We know people have visions, and we know that kind of culture can dictate the content of visions and so on. So we look at the kind of cultural context for things like, you know, something like the background of martyrdom, for instance, the background of, you know, how would people try to explain something as problematic as a crucifixion and a raised figure and so on.
You might go down that road of, well, whatever these experiences were, they were visions. They were a hallucination, possibly. I don't know if that's a bit of a pejorative term.
Yeah, I'd probably drop that term now. I may have used it if someone rings in and tells me off. I think these days I'd prefer to drop the term hallucination. It's not that, I mean, it could have been hallucination for all I know, but I'd prefer to think of this in terms of people saw it. People really did think they saw
visions. And they strongly believed it enough that it sort of became...
It was important for them.
To them, it almost was a physical event in their life.
Well, I'm sure they all thought
they believed it was a physical
event. They really did believe this, and I'm fine with that.
Okay.
And I think it makes it easier if we think of it at this level. It means that we can go on and talk about historical development without getting into questions I just simply can't answer.
So quite a few things to pull out there, both whether it's plausible that these could have been visions, which people believe so strongly that they believe they'd seen the risen Jesus, Gary, but also that whole question of, is it beyond the remit of the historian to posit supernatural events? We can talk about what people believed. They believed they had seen a supernatural event, but we can't say it was a supernatural event.
Well, I do think there's some limit on what historians can say and not say if we ask only what are they trained to do, because they're not trained to, you know, no. I doubt very many historians, professors would say, now we have the supernatural category and here's how you know that one. However, I do think there's some ways to get to that kind of belief. And, for example, one way I often do it is to break down what really is resurrection. We don't have to get this all souped up with, well, he came down from the heavens and there was glorious golden clouds and it was shined all, you know, all over the world, and there was this and there was that. These bombastic things. It could be this simple. Did the man Jesus die on the cross? And virtually every scholar who writes today in the area, New Testament, theologian, philosopher, historian, who writes in the area, will say he died. Next question. Was he seen afterwards? Now, that's a pretty, in a sense, we can juice it up and say, now, was he raised? Okay, I'm not so much asking what the event was. I'm just saying, did you see him later? I mean, I'm trying to ask, it seems to me the New Testament is saying something, especially the Gospels, but they're saying something as mundane as, Justin, I know I saw you in the supermarket the other day. Now, I mean, one of the scenes is fishing. One of the scenes is walking in the countryside. Historicity aside, I'm just saying that they're trying to say these were normal things.
Yeah.
And so I have one way to go after this to me is two questions. Did he die? Yes. Was he seen? Now, we can say, man, I don't know how we can push that. But I'm asking the was he seen question, not was it a miracle question. I like James divorces the belief from the views of New Testament.
Sure.
And I may not have said that exactly right, but I divorce was Jesus seen after the cross and was it a miracle? I think that's a separate philosophical move.
Okay.
So was it a miracle? But I just try to ask the question, did he die? And was he, in effect, seen in the supermarket 3 days later? I mean, was he seen physically? And I think we have data that can go there. Now, I've got other considerations to bring in here. But whenever you ask a miracle question, even according to David Hume, you're asking a question about the supernatural realm. I would rather bracket the supernatural realm and just say, was he seen in the some normal circumstance?
Okay.
Yeah. Walking, talking.
Yeah. That's interesting, because I guess that sounds more or less the kind of angle I'm coming at this from. The only, just one slight qualification on this is, I wonder if the supermarket analogy is a little too mundane in one respect, because the text clearly presenting this as something a bit more dramatic than that, aren't they? You know, there's the shock that that Jesus appears and things like
that. Well, I get you, and I can understand that. In fact, I could even agree with you partly on that. But the two men walk into Emmaus. I mean, I'm not talking about the historicity of the account. I'm talking about the way they present this belief. This man just walks up, and they say, oh, you must be a stranger. You didn't hear what's going on in Jerusalem today. It's a very casual conversation. Or the seashore. I'm going fishing. Yeah. So am I. A bunch of getting a boat.
Like you say, it's not angels and hallelujahs from the sky.
Oh, right. You know what? Yeah, yeah. There's no appearance of Jesus short of Paul, Damascus. I'm bracketing Paul again. But there's no appearance proper that Acts says is in the first 40 days. No appearance proper that is accompanied by light. We always have that in our paintings.
Probably in our paintings, yes.
Jesus is stepping over the prostate guards, and there's lights all over, and he's got a halo. No light in the early, you know, in the early accounts. So it's fairly mundane.
Right. I see what you mean. I suppose the point is, you're saying, okay, all I'm asking people to consider then is this: he died, and he was seen again afterwards.
That's it. And then we can start talking
But then it does, of course, lead to that question. You know, for James, it has to be some other explanation to account for these appearances.
Well,
that
you
people
know,
say they
I
had.
Suppose, I suppose Jesus could have died, been seen again, and been. I suppose it could have been a natural event. For example, if the fellow who dies and rises is a street person who lives under the bridge in a particular city, and the news is this guy had this rush to the hospital, he was declared dead, and now he's walking around again, we'd say, well, that's strange, because a person who's a street person or doesn't have any theological baggage of any sort, we don't have anything to label him with. Mm-hmm. But like he was saying, the early church started putting a whole bunch of labels on things as soon as it happened. But I would like to just talk about that first stage. Was he dead? Was he seen later? Then we could talk about what does being seen mean, if we could agree on being seen.
I mean, do we agree on him being seen, then?
Yes. I mean, I think that's fairly clear that we do. You know, just, I mean, again, just a qualification on what you said, Justin. It's not that I would say that, you know, we must have an alternative explanation per se. It's more, as a historian, I think we can give explanations only so far.
Sure.
So if people, you know, really, you know, today really believe that resurrection really took place and really, really was a supernatural event, well, you know, I mean, that's fine by me. That's terrific. Yeah. But, you know, if I was a historian, though, I just say I cannot prove those kind of claims. That's
the funny thing is to hear you as an agnostic New Testament historian saying, I believe people really did see Jesus, you know, it's so far from what I see a lot on the atheist internet sites, where they say basically poo-poo any kind of idea. He said these were all written down way after. They're all, it's all mythical, you know. It's all legendary accumulation. You know, why would I believe someone who told me 20 years ago I saw a guy raised to life who came up to me on the street? And they kind of put it in that sense of it's fairy tales, basically. Mm-hmm. But you don't sound like you're saying that as a non-believing New Testament historian.
I mean, I'm perfectly comfortable with the idea, and I think it did happen, that people invented stories, created stories, what we would call fiction and so on. I don't have a problem with that as such. But also, I mean, you think cross-culturally, people do claim to see visions of all sorts of things. Now, whether it's the kind of Jesus, whether it's any other kind of religion or culture, it's not in my. I have no interest in kind of debunking those claims or saying that all these people are liars. I mean, because that's clearly not the case. You know, I'm sure people do make these things up, but clearly, in so many cases, that people really, really believe this. And it's not my. I don't see it as my kind of function to go around saying. I mean, I might do privately if someone comes up to me. I say, well, yeah, all right, whatever. But I mean, but as a historian or as kind of a cultural analyst, there's other questions I want to ask of this kind of material, and I don't really want to be going around saying your views are absolutely crazy or wrong or stupid. Sure. I want to understand them in their cultural context.
I mean, in the cultural context as well, James says, Gary, okay, people having visions that are culturally relevant to them is something we see. So if that were, you know, the basis for an explanation of what the disciples and followers of Jesus thought they were seeing, would that work? Would you expect them to have a vision of the resurrected Jesus if it wasn't, an actual appearance of the Jesus?
I often argue that the divide, the point of which side scholars are on, is what they do with the visions.
Mm-hmm.
And if something happened to Jesus, it falls down the more conservative side of the slide, although some of the views aren't conservative. And if nothing happened to Jesus himself, but only happened to the disciples, mm-hmm. that goes down the other side, sure. which is a clear, in the old days, that was a Boltmannian position.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Boltmann, for all his skepticism, said we can be sure that the disciples thought they saw the risen Jesus, and that for an historian, we have these real experiences in space and time. I mean, that's Boltmann.
Yeah.
So if somebody were to say what I called in a lecture yesterday, I called it a Jedi Jesus view, because in one of the Star Wars movies, Luke looks across the campfire and he sees Obi-Wan and Yoda and Darth Vader now, who has a quote-unquote deathbed conversion, and they're all standing around the campfire, but they're kind of see-through bodies, and they're like platonic glorified
ghostly figures. Yes,
that used to be a very popular view of the resurrection,
mm-hmm.
With Hans Gross, and in this, you know, west of Germany, Reginald Fuller, Joachim Jeremias. There's a lot of people who held that kind of disembodied, luminous.
Yes.
It's not so popular today, but what I'm saying is I would still call that a resurrection view. Here's my question. Did it happen to Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're led to believe that it really was Obi-Wan Kenobi standing around that fire. So I favor a bodily resurrection.
Mm.
But if Jesus appears in any sense, if something happened to Jesus, if he's alive after the crucifixion, that's a resurrection. That's a resurrection of species.
The other question I was going to ask, and to either of you really, but I also know that other people like Tom Wright have suggested, but in fact, it would have been very contrary to their expectations for Jewish people to see their Messiah resurrected, because resurrection was something that happened at the end of time rather than in time as well. So in a sense, if you're saying, oh, you know, people had visions, so it's kind of explainable that they had a vision of their resurrected Messiah. Well, no, that wouldn't be what they were expecting to see at all. You wouldn't expect them to have that kind of a vision. That's a very unusual vision to be having if that's the vision they had.
Yes. There's a number of ways. I think Wright goes harder on the supernatural causality issue. But there's a number of ways first of all, humans are very complicated things, and something quite complicated happened to these people. Who knows how they would have interpreted it? So to go there for the supernatural is where I have the difficulties. I also think he's not exactly correct in that Jewish people, I mean, I think he generalises quite a lot about the Jewish view and things. And I think it's not entirely correct that you couldn't get resurrections, people thinking there were resurrections in here and now. Herod Antipas, for instance, he thought Jesus was John the Baptist or whatever, resurrected. Now Jesus was flesh and blood at this point. There's the story of the dead saints rising in Matthew's account just after the crucifixion. So these things are attested as such as stories or whatever you want to call them. There was some kind of belief that this could happen in the present, before end times. So there's a number of things that could go on there. There's also stories about martyrs looking forward to their resurrection. You get this in the Maccabean literature as well. And this looks like it implies some kind of physical resurrection too. And again, that could have influenced the ways in which the earliest Christians understood these visions they saw of Jesus.
So you don't think it's ruled out in that sense?
No, I don't think so. I think Wright generalises far too much about what Jews expected. And I think it's quite typical of his work that it's kind of so broad brush, sometimes you miss the little details, you know, the contradictory views.
Any comment on this, Gary?
But yet, I often teasingly say Tom Wright's written the longest word study in history, 550 pages on Gnosticism and Aguero. You do agree, if I get this from your writings, if I get this correctly, that the earliest Christian view was a proclamation, in spite of my Jedi Jesus. I was just saying, as a typology,
sure,
that would still be resurrection. Yeah. But the New Testament belief was bodily in nature. They thought that what they saw, I think you say something like visions bodily interpreted or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so on that point, you would say Tom Wright is probably right on when he talks about those two words every time they're used, whether it's Gentiles, Christians, or Jews. Those words are always used bodily.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to go through all the words to see if it is to use the word always, but I think broadly
generally,
speaking, again,
I don't think
there's a problem with that at all.
Yeah, now, Tom has a lot stronger view in that, but about how many. Yeah, he makes it sound like it's always, but at least it's a broadly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right, and I think the Jedi analogy is kind of interesting because we can't really get a full handle on what they thought they were seeing. Obviously, they thought it was a human being. I think this is right. Someone who pops up by in a mason and so on. And there's an interesting, Mark 6, where they thought Jesus was a ghost.
Yeah.
Now, what on earth is going? There is clearly some overlap between something like that Obi-Wan Kenobi thing and a bodily figure that could be. Who knows what?
Let's hear from you, though, Gary, because I don't want us to run out of time before getting to this core issue of why, for you, even as a historian, we shouldn't necessarily preclude in this case a miraculous explanation. So if we've got to the point of saying Jesus died, people saw him again, why, for you, is it valid to put forward as the best explanation what the disciples said happened?
Yep, and I would say, from my own view, I would add the last thing I just said about Tom Wright. I would say he died, he was seen, and it was bodily. Just like if you saw somebody at the supermarket, it's bodily. Okay, now how do we get from there to supernatural then? You have to bring in worldview aspects. It's a philosophical question if this is a natural world or a supernatural world. And so I think a lot has to be done with other things. I'll just give some hints on where I would go.
Okay.
First of all, it's the person of Jesus himself. We're not talking about the street person who something incredible happened in the hospital last night, but he's not found in any religion anytime soon, so we can't do anything religious with him. But with Jesus, you've got a person who made rather unique claims about himself. Scholars rejected in the 70s, but now pretty much accept that he was a miracle worker of some sort, whatever you take that definition to mean, that the things the Gospels described as those events, those or something like them occurred. Some now, a wide number, the same journal we've been talking about, Journal for the Study of the Historical Jesus, recently published an article, 6 Critical Reasons Why Jesus Predicted His Resurrection Ahead of Time. So if he predicted it ahead of time, that just doesn't say something happened to him. It says he knew about it. Well, if you say someone knows about something, now you're talking foreknowledge. If it's foreknowledge, you're talking worldview. So some things about Jesus, he's a very, I would argue, I'm thinking of Stephen Neal's book, at Oxford, Christian Faith and Other Faiths, Most Unique Person Who Lived in History, and this is the World Religions book. The event happened to the most unique person who ever lived in history. I think that's an odd combination of all things coming together, and now you start wondering, who do people say he was? I do agree with Larry Hurtado and Richard Baucom, who say, coming out of the gate in 30 AD, you've got a resurrection, and you've got very high Christology because they're worshiping him. Now, the worship part's Hurtado. Baucom,
I mean, they changed to meeting on the first day of the week, for goodness sake.
They did.
That's one of your facts, isn't it?
And they, well, one of the larger
one
facts.
One of the larger facts.
And they started using verses applying to Jehovah in the Old Testament, applying to Jesus in the New. And what do you do with 1 Corinthians 8:6? And it looks like he's moved into the Shema now. Hear, O Israel, Lord your God is one. And here's Jesus in that. So some things are going on very early. That's one thing. I'd also say for people who are skeptical about the natural world and whether there is a supernatural world, I would start talking about near-death experiences, which you mentioned earlier. And I'd say, let's just drop Jesus for a minute. Let's talk about NDEs. I do not think NDEs are worldview specific, but I've collected over 100 evidential cases. And it's fairly wide belief that NDEs offer some minimal belief in an afterlife. The thing I'd say there is, if there's some view, even minimally, for an afterlife, and resurrection is in a category called afterlife, you can't rule out resurrection because you don't like supernatural if there are these things called NDEs around, which also have already evidentially introduced the world of the afterlife. So I could say other things, but those are, that's how I would get to a supernatural event.
So you, as you say, Gary, it moves us into a philosophical questions about whether we can accept the supernatural as a...
Right.
Now, does this mean that essentially you can bracket that off, James, as, well, then that's a philosophical question and I don't have to deal with it in my history. But it sounds like what Gary's saying is it inevitably impinges on the historical question.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure. I mean, Gary would be coming at this... if you're coming at this from a philosophical perspective first, and I think Gary kind of shifts between the two, but let's take a hypothetical person who's not in this room who does, then you are impinging on historical questions fairly obviously. You would have to, you know, you might want to collect the data for near-death experiences. You might want to analyse the gospel traditions and so on to see if these kind of philosophical claims can be supported and so on. Again, you know, what I would do with this is it wouldn't be to debunk the claims made by people who have near-death experiences or the like. I would say, well, what do these people experience? And I would happily leave it at that level again. Level of belief, what does it tell us? Is this a cultural phenomenon? Is it a cross-cultural phenomenon? Does it tell us something specific about the individual, culture, society, and so on? To pick up on comments Gary made about Jesus predicting resurrection. I think this is really quite interesting. Again, it's very difficult to show this with any certainty because the Gospels are written after the resurrection. So it's not a stupid argument to say that the Gospel writers could have creatively developed these kinds of things. But if you think John the Baptist has been killed, Jesus is going to Jerusalem. He knows if he does something like he does in the temple, he's probably going to get killed as well. Mm-hmm. Prophets know that it's very simple. You get killed.
He knew he was on a road to probably.
Yeah, he would have had to be very, very naive to think that he could have got away, you know, unscathed. Right. So it wouldn't surprise me if some of the kind of predictions about his death go back to the historical Jesus, if I can't prove it. But that would, of course, entail a resurrection of some sort, one way or the other. The late Maurice Casey was much more conservative than me on these kind of things, but he, and this is someone who taught before, identified as irreligious, so this is no kind of believer by any stretch of the imagination, but he thought that Jesus did predict his resurrection of sorts, but that he would have thought, I think I'm representing him fairly here, that this would be more of a kind of spiritual, I don't want to use that word, resurrection or something like that, that would have been...
Maybe a Jedi.
Maybe a Jedi, something like this. Yeah, he would have gone, you know, he would have gone off with the Order and so on. And he thought that you could reconstruct some of the early gospel traditions in that respect. Now, whether he was right in reconstructing those traditions is another question, but if you think of the general picture, if he thought he was going to die, he presumably thought he was going to be resurrected in some way. So there is something you can do with that.
Okay.
Very difficult.
We'll come back to this in a moment's time. We're already at the end of our second part. We've just got a final 10 minutes to start summing up our thoughts on today's show. It's been really interesting talking about whether the minimal facts support the resurrection of Jesus. My guests today on Unbelievable, Gary Habermas and James Crossley, and we'll be concluding our conversation on this here on the show that aims to get you thinking from both sides of the spectrum. Unbelievable. Hello and welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable, your weekly edition of the show that brings you all kinds of debates on faith, history, biology, science, scripture, apologetics, and all the rest of it. Thanks to all those who listen via podcast as well as online and via the radio. If you want to catch up on past shows, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable is the place to go, and loads of great other features, articles, resources, and so on if you go there, as well as links, of course, to the podcast. Now, we had some really interesting feedback to the last couple of weeks with Tim McGrew debating sceptical Bible scholar Bart Ehrman, and I'm going to be bringing that shortly. Next week on the programme, we're continuing our Summer of Scripture, as I'm joined again by James Crossley and Gary Habermas, as they take some of the questions that you asked on social media recently. I asked you to send in your Bible questions about the New Testament, and we're going to be hearing their different perspectives as a Christian and agnostic Bible scholar on some of the questions that came in. So listen out for that at the same time next week. A little later on today, between 4 and 5 on the profile, I'm going to be speaking to former BBC producers Chris Rees and Patrick Forbes about the classic BBC series Priestland's Progress, which will be re-airing on Premier between Monday and Thursday in the coming week and in the next few weeks over the summer. So if you're able to stick around for that between 4 and 5, you're in for a treat as they reminisce about what was a groundbreaking series in its day for BBC Radio 4. But here on Unbelievable, we're getting back into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
It's been a real pleasure to have James Crossley and Gary Habermas join me for the first of two shows where they're looking at issues around the New Testament, the historicity of the claims of Jesus and so on. Next week, we're going to be discussing some of your questions that you've sent in for them. But today we've been asking, do the minimal facts support the resurrection of Jesus? And that's certainly the point of view of Gary Habermas, who's a scholar of history and philosophy out at Liberty University, Virginia. More on him and his work at GaryHabermas.com. James Crossley says he broadly agrees, actually, as we heard earlier on in the programme, with the minimal facts that Gary puts across. Quibbles over some of the longer list, if you like. But that doesn't mean that we have the ability, really, as historians, to posit a supernatural event as the basis for the growth of Christianity, the transformation of the disciples, the experiences they had, and everything else. So that's kind of where we've come to. The crux of this issue is, are we allowed the supernatural in that sense as an explanation of historical data? What's interesting is I've said that we're having those listener questions next week for you guys when we come to do that show. But a number of people did get in touch on the issue of the resurrection, including Peter. And he had this question to you, James, which I think kind of encapsulates where we've got to so far. So see what you think of this. He says, if, for the sake of argument, we were to accept that a God of some kind exists, and secondly, miracles are possible, i.e. this God can cause things to happen in the world which otherwise couldn't happen, would the Gospels then be sufficient to show that the resurrection happened? So say you granted God and the possibility of miracles, would the data we have, if you like, from the minimal facts, be sufficient to show, well, I won't even say that the resurrection happened, that it's the best explanation of the facts, if you like.
I mean, this is the problem. I mean, if you bring these assumptions into play, then it makes that kind of argument that bit easier, obviously. So if we assume that God exists, mm-hmm. and we assume that God intervenes in history, and it was fairly obvious to all of us that this was happening, then, of course, something like the resurrection would be a part of the game. The problem is, of course, these are, again, philosophical arguments, yes. Arguments about belief and commitment. I don't know how you'd prove these things, with all due respect to William Lane Craig. I'm sure, but, you know, these are, how do you prove that God exists and from the get-go? You know, it's very difficult to persuade someone like me that miracles are happening all around me. So I'm very happy to stick to the kind of more mundane historical game that, we just explain belief and ideas and causes in terms of sort of economics, social context and so on. So you would have to, it would be a different game
Do you, in that sense, are you committed as a historian to what you might term a naturalistic view of history, i.e. one that excludes the miraculous specifically, and there is always a natural explanation for every event?
Not quite. I mean, I think broadly, yes. So if I wanted to try to explain Christian origins, I might say something like, well, there are these economic reasons, there are these social reasons, there are these political reasons. But clearly, they thought that something like the resurrection was important. I think it was very. I agree with the comment made earlier that that resurrection generates a lot of Christological thinking. Mm. Now, what's that? Well, that's at the level of belief. That is not to say, I'm not saying, therefore, all this is kind of just material explanation. I'm saying that's all I can do.
Okay.
So I'm not going down the line. And I don't know if Gary's ever made this criticism of people, but I've come across the criticism. No, it was Michael Lycona made the criticism, and it's not unreasonable that. You're saying, not me, but others are saying, if I use these explanations, it's like kind of almost a God of the gaps in reverse.
Right.
I can explain this. Everything must be explained materially. Mm. I'm not quite saying that. I'm just saying this is all we can do.
All we can do. Okay, got that. Okay, where do you fall on this about the... do you think, for instance, that James kind of unfairly, if you like, has a naturalistic bias in the way he comes to the... Do you think James should kind of... have, you know, be open at some level to the miraculous in the way he does his history?
I'm hearing some of his natural language, but I think James, I've done a lot of this, as he has, with people, written, we've dialogued on the resurrection with an Oxford book. I think of all the people I've talked with, he may be the most honest and forward person because he always tries to be very careful. I mean, before we went on the air, he can correct me, but he made the comment he prefers the word vision, not hallucinations.
Yeah, he said that on air, yeah.
And, right, but that it could be objective, it could be subjective. He can't rule them out. I think that's a very fair kind of thing. Mm. I would say this, and like the distinction he made earlier, I may not be saying this to James, but a good deal of people who do make this kind of move, they do say history must be interpreted either methodological naturalism, so at least methodologically, or metaphysical naturalism. And I would say one problem with that is that it cuts both ways. If believers have believers' glasses and unbelievers have stronger naturalists than what I hear coming from him, but if they have naturalistic glasses, they're both prejudices. Both those are angles on the data. So we have to be careful of angles. And I would also say that naturalism can't be proven. I mean, even Bertrand Russell said that. Bertrand Russell saying something to the effect of, I would never say anything so stupid as God's existence can be disproven.
Right.
So naturalism can't be proven. And the third thing, one qualification about NDEs, when he said he takes them on the belief level, I think that follows logically from what he said earlier. But I want to make it clear, if I didn't make it clear earlier, on the NDEs, I collect and theorize only on the evidential cases, only on the cases where somebody, quote-unquote, dies for 30 minutes. I mean, no measurable flat brain or heart activity in this room. Let's just say there's no windows. But while we're all worried about them and the paramedics are coming in and working on them, they're watching an accident take place out in the parking lot. Later, they can explain the accident, even though there's no known heart or brain activity. To me, that kind of stuff is way beyond the belief-only aspect. That sounds like an eyewitness comment that can be verified or falsified.
We obviously don't have time to go into that particular aspect. It is another fascinating...
I just want to add that clarification.
Yeah,
sure. It's not just that I'm interested in...
Yeah.
And he didn't say this,
yeah,
but I'm not just interested in tunnels and lights, and they said, wow, it was a great experience. I'd say, okay, that's nice, but let's talk about the accident.
Just one more question before we start to wrap this up. Just recently, I had Bart Ehrman on the show, and we covered this briefly, this issue of can you have a miraculous explanation for. And his thing he came back with was, we don't do that anywhere else in history. You wouldn't do that for any other historical event, Gary. It's like, you know, so why do we only do it for this particular event? You know,
it's a great question. You know, Bart, in his latest book, says history can't prove the resurrection. Bart also says history can't disprove the resurrection. That's a really odd comment coming from him lately. So he tries to say, and then he says there's two ways to know things, by empirical data and by belief. I'm thinking, ooh, that's a little tough. But I'm just saying he's introducing some categories, and some categories have come up today where there's some appreciation.
Yeah.
Of
but what about this claim that you don't do it anywhere else in history? You wouldn't accept a miraculous explanation for other things in history. Why only this event? Are you being, you know, are you too narrow-minded in that sense?
Well, Bart, I think, is talking about history there, because he says over and over and over again, he says historians can't tell these things. But philosophers have different sorts of tools. And maybe at this point, history has to lean over the fence to philosophy, or philosophy leans over the fence to history. But I do think philosophy has some things to say. For example, we talked about God's existence, near-death experiences. What do you do with, it's not just the resurrection of anybody, it's the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And that introduces things in the Gospels that are not easily explained. And he's a very odd person for this to be the only one that has happened to, as far as we know. So I do think there's some extenuating circumstances here. But I'd have to call in philosophy for a little bit of backup at this point.
We've run out of time almost. So just a chance for a final couple of comments from you both. James, as we finish up
today's
show.
To pick up on that last issue, actually. I mean, I think I would agree with Batterman's idea that, you know, it can either prove nor disprove. I mean, I think that's pretty much where I'm coming from on this as well. The other side is, you know, why has this been brought in? I think, you know, every kind of field, every kind of area is ideologically loaded. And, you know, there are a lot of Christians, for fairly obvious reasons, doing New Testament studies. So, of course, their kind of interest will come to the fore. Just as, you know, Marxist historians on Soviet Russia or something, their interest will come to the fore. So you've got to look at the kind of interests of the field on this. And I think that's why this kind of issue about supernatural explanation will rise far more than it would in, say, you know, miraculous appearances elsewhere in, say, the Greco-Roman world or something like this. They'll have their own interests, their own ideological interests, of course, but I think that's probably the a key reason anyway. Yes.
No one's staking their faith these days on the appearance of Artemis in a temple.
No. So, you know, there's not going to be endless debates about that. It's just not going
to
happen.
No, I think he's right. That's another way to say we have to bring worldview, larger pictures into this too. So I agree.
Yeah. Gary, if people want to read more on the minimal facts, what's the best resource you could point them to? You can give your website if you like.
Well, the website, there's a lot of things, GaryHabermas.com. Mike Lacone and I have a less complicated book called The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus. I've got a grad-level book called There Isn't Jesus and Future Hope. Mike Lacone's book, Resurrection of Jesus, Historical Perspective, has been highly acclaimed by scholars who are agnostic. So... I think those are places I'd look.
Great. Thank you very much. James, I'll give another mention, even though I guess it's far wider ranging than just the issue of the resurrection, but to your book, Jesus and the Chaos of History, out from Oxford University Press, isn't it? So anyone who wants to get their teeth into some really meaty stuff.
It's only about £15 as well.
Well, there you go. Bargain. what can you say? So we look forward to you both joining me, though, for a second bite of the cherry on the next programme, when we're going to be looking at some of the questions you've sent in via email, via Twitter, via Facebook, and we're going to cover quite a wide variety of issues to do with the New Testament accounts of Jesus on next week's programme. So for the moment, thank you both, James and Gary, for joining me this week.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
As ever, if you want to get in touch about anything you've heard on today's programme, and I'm pretty sure today's programme as well will generate a lot of feedback, then why not email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. The ways to get in touch are also listed on the website at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and look forward to you leaving your comments there underneath the most recent edition of the programme. Lots of people do weigh in with their thoughts and opinions on recent editions of shows in the comments section underneath each show, but a lot of people also come in via Facebook, and I'm going to read out some of your thoughts from Facebook that came onto the Unbelievable Facebook page in regard to last week's show between Tim McGrew and Bart Ehrman. And just a reminder, the second of those two debates that we had last week was on undesigned coincidences in the Gospels and whether, as Tim McGrew claims, they give a sort of corroborating evidence for the historicity of the Gospels, and he was debating Bart on that. Well, we've still had a lot of feedback to the first show, in which Bart Ehrman and Tim were debating the general reliability of the Gospels. In particular, I was pointed in the direction of Lydia McGrew's blog, and if you want to look that up for yourself, just search for Lydia McGrew online. And Lydia is, as you can probably guess from the name, the wife of Tim McGrew, and she's no slouch when it comes to the Bible and historical apologetics and so on herself. And she's actually written a very long post. It's a really sort of book length almost, actually, responding to some of the issues that were raised in that first programme between Bart and Tim. So I do encourage you to go and look at it. I was very impressed with the amount of work that gone into this very scholarly response to some of the issues raised, particularly Bart Ehrman's claim that the Gospels were anonymous and therefore we don't have any sort of real evidence that they were written by the people they claim to be written by. And Lydia goes into a lot of depth on this. I can only really read out a couple of paragraphs or so. But in this blog post, she says, "This claim in various wordings is made by Ehrman times without number in his writings on the subject of who wrote the Gospels. And the claims that the Gospels were originally anonymous also comes up in the podcast with Tim. Tim points out in the radio debate around minute 29 that the sense in which Ehrman is using the word anonymous is compatible with everyone's having always known who wrote the Gospels. Tim points out that all that's meant by their being formally anonymous and all that can be shown is that in the body of the text, the book's author does not identify himself. This point deserves emphasis. It's an absolutely standard part of Ehrman's approach to this issue that he defines anonymous in a very narrow sense, which is impossible to dispute, but then slides in his usage to a much broader meaning without defending the slide. In the debate around minute 33, Ehrman tries to say that this is not a technicality. That's what anonymous writings are, he says. Anonymous writings are books where the author does not tell us their names. But let's think about that for a moment. If that is literally all that is meant by anonymous, then the Gospels are still anonymous today, for the bodies of their texts have not changed. And the authors did not name themselves in the body of the text. More, a great many modern books on your shelves and mine are anonymous in this fairly pointless and, yes, technical sense. If you glance through the body of the text of many, many books, articles and even blog posts, you'll find that the author almost never pauses and names himself in the body of his text. Why would he? That's what a title page superscription or subscription at the end of the article or post is for. And it goes on in various, like, to sort of rebut and so on various of the points that Bart M. and Boyne brought up in that first of the two debates. Very interesting analysis of what was said, obviously coming in very strongly on Tim's side. Goes on to say about Emmon's argument from silence in that debate, that Emmon calls a striking thing about the silence of Justin Martyr, one of the church fathers, that he doesn't name any of the authors of the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And this argument, she says, is an extremely weak one. There could be many reasons why the writings of Justin that we currently have don't name Matthew et al. As authors, the most obvious of which is that those author attributions were well known among the audience to which Justin was writing, and that he found his most common phrase, Memoirs of the Apostles, to be a convenient shorthand for the purposes of the point he was making. And finally, she sort of also weighs in towards the end of the article on the question of whether the, if you like, early church had theological reasons for wanting to attribute Gospels to certain people. And she says it should be obvious that when it comes to Ehrman's claim that the external evidence for the Gospels is tainted because we know that those making the attributions had ideological reasons, there is no there there. In the absence of positive historical evidence, Bart Ehrman has given his own assumptions, dressed up as elaborate ad hoc hypothesizing, but that does not amount to an argument. The simple fact is that our external evidence about the authorship of the Gospels all points one way and only one way, and that there is a cumulative body of such evidence. An attempt to obscure this by chopping the evidence up into pieces and trying to explain away each piece separately by a combination of tendentious phrases, question begging, storytelling, and sometimes outright misrepresentation. It is the job of anyone who wants to know the truth to step back instead and look at the external case as a whole. Well, obviously, someone like Bart Ehrman doesn't necessarily have time to respond to all his critics online, but I wonder whether he might write a response to Lydia's very detailed discussion about the show. But thanks, Lydia, for writing that. Maybe we should have Lydia on at some point down the line. Obviously, as I say, knows her stuff when it comes to historical biblical studies. Anyway, let's go to some of your other feedback in response to that programme. Here's, for instance, Michael Arndt, who says, I've been listening to your show for some years. Really appreciate the variety and high quality of these discussions, which are really inspiring to engage in personal conversations with non-believers. And you're referring now to primarily the second debate, as I say, on undesigned coincidences, which wasn't the focus of Lydia's article there. But Michael, you say, nevertheless, I was pretty annoyed by the prevailing attitude of personal disrespect and the unprofessional way of engaging each other in discussion. Disagreement is to be expected, but I got the impression that they just wanted to expose the opponent as unworthy of being considered as a proper historian. Therefore, it was quite an impressive feat of yours to actually make them talk to each other again. All things considered, I'd say this debate was much more balanced than the previous one, because this time Tim McGrew seemed to be well prepared to face Bart Ehrman's criticism and make some good arguments on his own. Similar emails came in from people about the sort of the tone of the debate. Here's Jason in Bridgewater, Massachusetts, says, I was completely disgusted with Tim McGrew's puerile performance on last week's debate with Bart Ehrman. When McGrew debated Pete Boghossian on your show, I thought he did a good job of challenging him respectfully. Against Bart Ehrman, however, he came across as pompous and pretentious. With long-winded, rapid-fire verbiage, he made much ado about the most menial points, and Ehrman had to continually interject that he actually agreed with him on most of what he had feverishly argued. I wish more time could have been spent on where they actually disagreed. Contrarily, I was impressed with Ehrman's humble and patient interaction with McGrew. I think I would have raised my voice quite a few times had I been in his place. The man deserved respect, not just for his position and accomplishments, but for his composure. You also wanted to say on that, Jason, that you were bothered by that McGrew avoided Ehrman's question regarding his presuppositions. Ehrman asked him if he was an inerrantist. That is a central question of tremendous significance to the main argument, and yet McGrew did everything he could to dodge this question. Anyway, you say, you finish up by saying, thanks for putting together an interesting and stimulating programme. Then on the other side of this, Matt as well comes in on this to say, thanks for a delightful debate between Bart Ehrman and Tim McGrew about biblical accuracy. I especially like it when the Christians in the debate get petulant and go for debate points, blood, the way McGrew seems to do. The irony is, well, electrifying. For me, the high point, which was also the low point of the debate, was their exchange on miracles, and specifically on Ehrman's comparison of the Bible stories to the fables surrounding the Baal Shem Tov. Here's what Tim McGrew calls historical context, most of us would call special pleading. I'm only sorry that Ehrman let himself get dragged into a debate about whether or not the early Christians were persecuted for reporting miracles, as though that were really salient. His point about the Baal Shem Tov, after all, is that here we not only have reports of miracles, but reports by early sources, much earlier than in the case of the New Testament. McGrew ham-fistedly tried to move the goalpost by talking about what other criteria, other than near eyewitness testimony, make the Christian stories veridical. Not being an expert on myths about the early Hasidism, I don't know to what extent they too were subjected to reprisals for their beliefs, but I'm probably safe in assuming that pretty much any time miracle claims are made by not yet established cults, they are first be met by criticism and disbelief by many, if not most people. Sorry, Tim, that doesn't make them any more credible. Now, here's some of your comments coming in via Facebook on that show. A lot of people wanted to respond that way after I posted it up at the Unbelievable Facebook page. If you want to like that page, simply go to Facebook and look for Unbelievable JB, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to like the page. I post things other than just the show details as well, of course, from week to week. I've got something most days going up that struck my interest. But Michael on there said, enjoyed it very much. Bart should have come prepared to defeat Tim on the credibility of the Gospels. Spiritual life cannot be discerned by logic. Logic is for scientific studies. It can never grasp the spiritual facts unless logic submits to the spirit. If Bart was a true believer, he would have understood Tim, but his views, if not all, failed him, although he made a few fair points. Thanks, Justin. Keep up the good work. Shane says, interesting conclusion to the debate. Once again, Tim fails to grasp basic logic. The coincidences he references are deeply unimpressive and easily accountable, even in the best case scenario, by background knowledge or narrative, and certainly don't add a ring of truth that substantiates anything more than prosaic claims. Taylor says, it's amusing to me what a big fuss the feedback at the end of last week's show contained about Bart pressing Tim on inerrancy, right after Tim spent the better part of this show defending speculative arguments that rely on pretty conservative and traditionalist assumptions about the Gospels. I was sceptical of pitting a philosopher against a New Testament scholar, and these last two episodes were a vindication of that. Tim did much better against Boghossian. On the other hand, Lacey says, I honestly don't understand why Bart was even on the show. He wasn't even prepared to admit basic principles of historic accuracy. His straw man of Dickens versus Melville proved as such when the Gospels were not only writing about the same time but the same events. His attitude was terrible. He laughed his way through the debate and referred to unintended coincidences that shed further light on different stories throughout the Gospel sarcastically as deep and mysterious. To me, it sounds like he's out to make money on his books by being a skeptic, which really anyone can do. I would be horrified if my child had him as a professor. Noel Goodman thinks that Tim wiped the floor with Bart. Brian Broom thinks it was completely the opposite way around. So, yes, everyone comes to these debates and takes away very different opinions of what happened. And if you're listening and wondering what did happen, you'll have to go and listen to it yourself, won't you? It's online now. In the meantime, thanks for being with me on the programme today. I'm looking forward to you joining me again at the same time next week as we continue our Summer of Scripture.
You're unbelievable.
We'll be having that Q&A between Gary Habermas and James Crossley. They join me again for next week's programme as you've submitted a number of queries, objections, questions to do with the New Testament. We'll see what they make of them. So come back again, same time next week. For the moment, thanks for being with me on the show today. Do join me again if you're listening here on Premier for The Profile, coming up next.